The future is a hefty responsibility and not one that we take lightly. But then taking things lightly has never been what Hefty is about. That's why we've created the Hefty Renew program that turns hard to recycle plastics into valuable resources like park benches and building materials. To participate, simply fill up an orange Hefty Renew bag with accepted items, tie it up, and drop it in with your regular recycling. That's it. It's that easy. It's time to rethink recycling with Renew. Particular valued resources may vary by geography. More info available at heftyrenew.com.
You've tuned in to Columbia Calling, your first stop for everything you want to know about Columbia. How and where to invest, where to visit. From the Pacific to the Caribbean, the Andes Mountains to the Amazon jungle, Columbia has a slice of everything. Shooting from the hip, answering the questions that need answering. Here's your host, the journalist and hotelier Richard McCall, shedding some light on the fashionable South American destination of Colombia.
This is Colombia Calling. I'm your host, Richard McCall, here in Bogota, Colombia. Shortly we'll be beginning episode 134 with our delightful interviewee, Natalia Quintero. We'll be talking about her life as part of the Colombian diaspora in the United States and, of course, what she's doing back here in Bogota. So it's always great to hear from people who come back, who take that knowledge acquired elsewhere, you know, acquired over time, difficulty, perhaps hardship, and then brought back here to Colombia to improve the situation, perhaps for entrepreneurs, as in Natalia's case. So we'll be talking to her in the next two segments of this show. Before we sign off quickly for that, though, it is curious what's going on in Colombia. And I received a comment the other day on, you know, it was a chat I was having on the Facebook chat. Someone saying, you know, Colombia seems that it's not so easy to fix given everything that's going on at the moment. And it's a tough one. I found myself at dinner the other night with a lot of people from Florida and California, an older bunch, but interested in Colombia, down here traveling, and I was happy to engage in conversation about the situation in Colombia. And of course, I am very concerned about what's going on with the armed strike that has taken place in the last few days here in Colombia, where the Usaga clan, or the sort of offshoot of paramilitary groups, has more or less shut and paralyzed, economically paralyzed, the north coast, if we think of areas in Magdalena, Bolivar, Cordoba is the sort of ground zero, Sucre, Antioquia, Chocó. They've, started a threat, threatened unions and workers not to open their businesses. It's a show of force. What I understand is it represents, an anniversary of the death of one of their top sort of commanders in chief. And it's a show, show de force of their desire to engage with the government in peace dialogues as if they were equal to or similar to the FARC or the ELN in this situation. Now, the government of Juan Manuel Santos refers to them as criminal gangs, mafias, and so on and so forth, and therefore will not participate on this level with the clan Usaga. And it's a very complex situation that we find. Now, you know, I have my small business up in Mompós in Bolívar, you know, 5-6 hours south of Cartagena along the Magdalena River. Mompós also was affected because the ferry operators and the chalupa, so motorized boats, the Johnsons, and that go from Magangay, the big, the second largest economic driver in Bolívar behind Cartagena, these guys were threatened as well. So they did not go to work on these days during the strike. So therefore, no tourists came in that way via sort of, let's say, from the coastal side via Magangay. And it's very worrying. And I am left with the doubt and question as to why nothing was done. If we are entering a positive period in Colombian history, a post-accord period, a potential post-conflict period, you know, before the year's out, I think that a final accord will be signed with the FARC. The ELN will take several years if they stay at the table, if both sides stay at the table, if the situations are favorable for both sides, because that's what conflict resolution is about. But why when we knew that this paro armado, this armed strike, was going to take place, was there not a mobilization of state forces in the region to permit that people could continue with their economic activities? It's very tough for me to understand this, and I do believe that even paro armado, the armed strike, has extended as far as Medellin as well. So it's sort of like the industrial, the motor of Colombia. So this is very concerning. And of course, this Saturday past, there was a march which was labeled as the March Against Impunity, organized by the Democratic Center Party. That's the Uribista party, against the agreements that are being created in Havana, Cuba, so where the peace talks have been taking place since November 2012 with the FARC, against the supposed impunity that will be sort of granted members of these guerrilla forces. Now, I don't know how well, I can't speak for how well these marches were attended. There is talk that the photographs that have been published are montages. I don't know. I don't know what to believe when you read the press here, because it's everything's so polarized. It's very difficult to get an accurate and objective source of information. So I don't even want to enter that. But the country is divided. The country is in a very delicate situation at this moment. And it does make me fear for the coming months. It does make me fear for what might have to be done. And now I can't predict anything. It's a tough situation here in Colombia. And those of us here in Colombia will be able to vouch for that. We are polarized one side or the other. And of course, the governments and the opposition are aiding that polarization. And my feeling is that at this point, at this incredibly delicate point in history, this actuality that is taking place at the moment, both sides should be pulling together in a form, in a way that we can, you know, together as a nation, move forward. If there is any way of moving forwards and pulling ourselves out of this more than 5-decade long civil conflict, surely both sides should be acting for the greater good. Maybe I'm naive in that, but surely that's what the aim should be. It's not what is agreed in La Havana. It's not what is happening there. It's how that is treated afterwards, after a final signing of any agreement. It's how it then proceeds within Colombian territory that matters. So it's a very troubling time in Colombian history right now. So I just wanted to reflect on that as the opening segment of this show, of episode 134, Colombia Calling. I am immensely grateful to all of you who download this show and listen to it at any time, early or late. It's really flattering that I still get upwards of 7,000 downloads per week on these shows. But this next interviewee who's coming up is Natalia Quintero, and she really is quite a special person on the show, episode 134, someone very positive, someone who talks with authority and with passion about what she's doing, and she knows she's making a difference. If you want to get in touch, of course, you can get in touch via our Facebook page. That's Colombia Calling. We're on Twitter, Colombia Calling, and our email is colombiacalling@gmail.com. The website, which I need to update, is colombiacallingradio.com. I'm Richard McCall. This is Colombia Calling. We'll be right back with Natalia Quintero talking about what she is doing here in Colombia, how a member of the Colombian diaspora has returned to Bogota from the United States. So don't go away. This is a great show we've got in the pipeline for you. Thank you again. And we're back. This is Columbia Calling. I'm Richard McCall here in Bogota, Colombia, 2,600 meters closer to the stars. And I'm here with a very special guest. This is episode 134. Can you believe this? 134 episodes of Columbia Calling. But I'm here with a very special guest, Natalia Quintero. Yes, you guessed right. She's Colombian. It's an unusual thing on Columbia Calling, but she's a Colombian who speaks perfect English. And for one reason, for the reason in that, aged 9, she left Colombia. I'm not going to tell you how old she is now, but age 9, she left Colombia and moved with her mother and brother, I suppose it is, to Los Angeles. This is where she grew up, between Los Angeles and New York. And she's now, in the twists and turns of life, she's a listener of Columbia Calling, which I'm very, very flattered about. But also, she's now come back to Colombia with an international brand called the Social Atom Group, based here in kind of Rosales Chapinero in Bogota, and she's going to talk to us a little bit about her views on Colombia as, let's say, a representative of the diaspora who's been able to come back and see with new eyes, as we'd say in Spanish. It's almost a literal translation there, but see with a new vision Colombia, because it is her country, it is her world. You know, this is very a great deal of heritage here. So, welcome on the show, Natalia.
Thank you so much for having me, Richard.
You're most welcome. Now, listen, you know, you left Colombia when you were 9 years old. How did this come about? Why did this come about?
So, it was really the decision of my mother. She, I think, maybe woke up one day and really thought that her children would have a better opportunity at life if we went to the United States and kind of built our lives there. Uh-huh. And, you know, she went to LA to explore that opportunity and found that there was a possibility of us really building a life there. And so we moved there in, I want to say 1998. And we stayed. We found it definitely to be an opportune place to grow as a family and to grow in the opportunities that the U.S. would afford us. And, you know, I think it really worked out.
Yeah, well, I think so too. I mean, you are leading this. Well, you're going to explain to me exactly what the Social Atom Group is, but you're leading this team here in Bogota. You're traveling around the world. You're traveling around South America. You're traveling within Colombia. It sounds like a complete success story. But I want to, before we move on to that, let's talk about this as a young Colombian girl moving to Los Angeles. I mean, it's a big change. It's a big change, but did you immediately move to, let's say, a Hispanic community to enable the culture shock to be lessened?
So that's actually a really funny question because my mom had a very funny strategy when she decided to move us to Los Angeles, and that strategy was primarily just not to tell us that we were moving to Los Angeles.
Okay.
And so, I was... I guess 9 when I got there, and not knowing that I was necessarily moving to the city, and as a kid not necessarily having a great concept of time, I didn't feel the shock because I never really felt like I moved to a different country. And I mean, apart from everyone speaking English, it's kind of easy to settle into a city where a lot of people speak Spanish, and there is a lot of cultural overlap between Latin American culture and American culture. And in a way, maybe Los Angeles is the easiest city, sort of the easiest gateway city to be a Hispanic immigrant just because of that overlap. So it wasn't really a difficult transition, I guess, in terms of culture shock. I think it was actually a very easy transition. And when you're 9, you pick up a language very quickly. So, to be honest, I actually didn't even realize that I was picking up a language at all.
Just a sponge, aren't you, at this age?
Yeah, when you are that age and, you know, your primary goal is to play with other kids and to know the rules to handball such that you can win at handball, you know, then you do whatever is necessary to communicate.
Yeah.
And that's kind of how you, you know, that's kind of just kind of how you pick it up, or at least it was in my case. And so it wasn't so difficult, really, the culture shock so much. I don't think I even felt culture shock until I was maybe in middle school when I started to realize that I had a bicultural identity that I would have to craft and create and grapple with.
It's an interesting one, but it sounds to me like you mastered it perfectly. But so this is, you know, when I think of California, I think more of Central Americans or maybe Mexicans. I think when I think of Colombians going to the U.S., I think of Miami, New York, that side of the United States. Were you in a minority, a Hispanic, or?
Yes, absolutely.
Okay.
Absolutely. I don't think we had many Colombian friends for a while, and I think any time that we did find some, we really tried to hold on to them. But I think most of our friends were, you know, if not Mexican, Brazilian, or from Guatemala. You're totally right, though. I think it is kind of funny that we ended up in LA and not in Miami
It's a curious choice that way, because, you know, and I go up to California with my Colombian wife, Alba. You know, she talks Spanish to everyone there, because everyone speaks Spanish, and they say to her, "Well, where's that accent from? I've heard of it in the telenovelas." You know, of course, these are El Salvadorian girls or Guatemalan girls, or you know, and they're like, "Well, no, actually, it's Colombian." But when we're in Miami, of course, she's, you know, just another Latina, another Colombian. She's nothing special. Well, of course, she is special, but nothing special linguistically. Now, you left in 1998, and that's a pretty pivotal time when we think about Colombian contemporary history. I mean, I know all history is contemporary, but 1998, you know, really recent history. This is when Andrés Pastrana was coming into power, and you know, was about, he won the elections with that photograph with him and Tiro Fijo of the FARC. I mean, that's really what turned the election. And you know, he started the sort of, was it Zona de Extensión in San Vicente Caguán. I mean, this is a hard time in Colombian, even in Colombian terms, this is a hard time. I'm sure not only your mother realized that you were going to be offered, let's say, greater opportunities in the U.S. I mean, they must have known that this is, you know, things had to be better elsewhere. But it's refreshing to see you back here. Now, I understand that you moved to the United States without your father. He just didn't want to go, right?
Yes, I know that sounds kind of funny, actually, but my parents have a very, I want to say maybe progressive or very open, I guess, a way of making decisions. My mom is what I would, in Spanish, called una mujer berraca.
Berraca.
and that's a very Spanish, that's a very Colombian term. You know, where she sees opportunity and where she sees an opportunity to get ahead, she will pursue that, and she will, you know, climb mountains and work three jobs and do whatever is necessary to, you know, make some progress. And so when she proposed this idea of this very tough idea, I think, of moving to a new country and kind of restarting a life sort of from scratch, my dad saw it as an interesting idea. My dad is a professor of applied math and physics, and I think he's a little bit more of a homebody, and I think he's a little bit less of a risk taker, maybe, and maybe it didn't seem as appealing to him as it seemed to my mother. And so, you know, very calmly, she said, she, you know, that's fine if he didn't want to go. So so he stayed and she went.
Just like that.
Yeah, just like that.
I like it. Just like, you know, there's no, as we would say in Spanish, rencor. There was no hard feeling or anything like this. It's just sort of, okay.
Yeah, I mean, I guess it's kind of a funny thing. It's very anomalous, I think, but they are so different and have such different personalities that I think they just understood that it didn't necessarily fit with my father's personality to uproot to a different country and, you know, just kind of start in the way that my mom was willing to.
And then, does your father work at a university here in Bogota?
No, my father is actually retired now. Yeah, and I think
a professor of applied math. I mean, it's a serious brain.
he's very much of a brain. You know, I think my father's ideal day starts with, you know, a 4:30 a.m. wake up, reading the newspaper, making some fresh Colombian juice, finding an old math textbook, and resolving math problems that he hasn't seen in a long time, you know? So I think that's a very specific and very particular personality, and maybe those hobbies would be a little bit more difficult to pursue as an immigrant in the United States.
I like to think of him now as, I've got this image of him as a Colombian Goodwill hunting. They're solving on the whiteboard, you know? So, but anyway, I don't know. I mean, it's just fantastic. And clearly you, your family, you know, you and your brother were afforded greater opportunities. And this is true, and I don't mean to say this with, you know, any ill feeling to Colombia, because Colombia is a country that offered me so much, but I have been contacted by, this is not your story, I know, but I've been contacted by people who have been adopted, you know, from Colombia, and they, one of the first things they write in their email is, you know, I realize the opportunities afforded to me in the United States or wherever have been greater than those I would have probably received in Colombia. So it's just the reality of these things. One thing that we're going to move on to, and I'm just going to alert my listeners to, this is Bogota's rain in the background. So, you know, finally it started to rain. We've been praying for rain and now it's finally started. So I apologize for this downpour, but there's not a lot I can do about it, and we need it. But talking about that, Natalia, and talking about the realities of growing up in Los Angeles and stuff, I mean, I believe you moved around Los Angeles as your lives changed.
Yes, definitely. So as an immigrant to Los Angeles, our very first neighborhood was a very Hispanic, I would say very specifically Mexican-dominated neighborhood, and maybe it wasn't the most privileged neighborhood in Los Angeles, but I think it was a very easy neighborhood to sort of learn about the U.S. just because there were so many Spanish-speaking people, and because Hispanic culture really prevailed there, it was very easy to not notice that we had indeed moved to a new country.
But it's excellent. I mean, this is something that enables your assimilation. And over the time, then you moved up. You moved from Playa Baja to Playa Alta, as we would say here, and things changed. And you made a conscious decision later on to move to New York. So Los Angeles to New York. So we're talking Bogota, Los Angeles, New York. What brought about the New York move?
So I think one of the things that has been very unique to my experience growing up in different cities is that I think I've grown up not only in different cities, but in different parts of those different cities. And one of the things that my family was able to do in Los Angeles is, as our opportunities improved, our geographical location also changed. And so, you know, where we might have initially landed in Los Angeles, we were only at for, you know, a few years, and then we moved maybe to a different area that had better opportunities, and then an even more different area that had even better opportunities. And I think in that process, I sort of realized that there's always somewhere to go up. And LA is a wonderful city, but I think it's a little bit more of a mellow city compared to the neurotic East Coast and at some point, I think I identified with the fast-paced life that you can find on the East Coast. And I realized probably after a summer that I did at Harvard taking classes in Cambridge, that that was more along the lines of my personality and the goals that I would kind of want for myself.
But it's fantastic, Natalia. I mean, your story is so positive about the move to the United States, but also coming back here. And this is something that I want to explore in the next section of the show, and is it your reactions to coming back to Colombia and seeing, I know you visited here as a holiday since leaving, but also but coming back here to work and live, albeit for you know, a contract or so on and so forth. It will be interesting to hear your reflections and how you feel about Bogota now. So this is Colombia Calling. I'm Richard McCall, and we're speaking to Natalia Quintero in a thunderous Bogota downpour. We'll be right back after a short break. Thank you for listening. And we're back. This is Colombia Calling. I'm Richard McCall, and we're here with Natalia Quintero. She's a Bogotana, born, raised until she was nine. 1998, her mother decided, we're moving to Los Angeles. I've been tuned into this show, you'll know that they left, willingly, her father stayed behind because this is, you know, much more his culture and his, it was his thing. But it's been an interesting chat so far, talking about really what it's been like to be a Colombian in the diaspora up in the United States. Now, we were talking before we came to an end about you moving off to New York and the fast pace of life. And you know, this is, I think this has really become your city, hasn't it? New York, you could say this is where you belong.
Yes, absolutely. New York is the city that I chose to move to, I think, as a young adult. And it was a conscious decision. And I think it's also been a conscious decision to stay in New York as my city.
Excellent. I mean, we love New York. I love New York. I lived in Washington Heights. I was known as White Chocolate. this is a while back now. But, you know, it's always, you know, what a great city to spend time in. But now let's come back to your Colombia side of things a little bit. I mean, so you left at age nine, and I know you came down to vacation in Colombia, you know, in the interim period between 1998 and now, you know, as you're back. Now you're working in Social Atom Group here in Colombia. Why is the Social Atom Group, what is the Social Atom Group, but why are they here in Colombia?
Yeah, so I did decide to move back recently, and really what I was excited about was the idea of coming back and working with a team of people that was excited to invest in Latin America, that was excited to invest in Colombia and really build out innovation opportunities and entrepreneurship as a means to economic development in Colombia and Latin America. And so what Social Atom really does is it invests in entrepreneurs across Latin America and some in the United States as well. This is Social Atom Ventures in part. And what my team does at Social Atom Group is it works with government officials and with other institutions in a variety of cities to help those governments invest in innovation as a means to economic development. It's been really an exciting thing to be exposed to and to collaborate on because opportunity and you know, social mobility is a very difficult thing in Latin America. And I think it's something where innovation and entrepreneurship play a very unique and progressive role in creating opportunities for people that may otherwise not have many opportunities. And it kind of close to my heart.
Fascinating to hear that, you know, that, you know, straight out with it, the social mobility is a tough one here. It is. I've been studying the history of Colombia and through urban architecture and for my studies at the moment, and it's a theme that repeats itself continually. In the time that you've been away and the time you've come back, have you seen any changes that you could like put your finger on regarding this kind of mobility or the lack of it?
That's a tough question. You know, I think Bogota and maybe a lot of cities are experienced so uniquely depending on what you have access to.
Mm-hmm.
So maybe now that I'm back in Bogota, in a different part of Bogota, and where my evenings consist of finding, you know, cool cocktail bars and, you know, up-and-coming artists, then my experience is so different than it maybe would have been, or it maybe might be if I just lived in a different part of town or had access to just a different group of friends or a different network. And so, you know, I think that's just such a tough question because it so depends on what you have access to, and access is such a problematic thing in Latin America. And I hope that it's different, but I think there are a lot of cultural barriers across Latin America around social mobility and around accepting classes outside of yours to mingle with yours, whether that be lower classes or, you know, higher classes accepting people from outside of their network to come in and kind of be a part of that network. So I hope it is different, but I frankly don't think I have an intelligible answer to that.
A good answer, though. You kept very clean there. You didn't jump on either side, onto either side of the fence on that one. You've protected yourself. As you can hear, the Bogota thunderstorm is unlike anything you've ever seen. We've had to actually move rooms because of the noise, but it's so good that it has been raining. We do need this rain. But tell me a little bit now. Can you tell us anything about some of the these small enterprises that the Social Atom Group has been helping? Can you name any, or is that confidential?
Well, they're not confidential. Our portfolio is the Social Atom portfolio is I think it's actually on our website, and we support a variety of up and coming businesses. They do have a few characteristics that kind of bind them all together. First, they are technology-based, often software-based. And second, they are usually selling to a wider global, if not entirely American and European market. I think one of the things that we're trying to push people to do is to look outside of Colombia and outside of Latin America for opportunities to grow their businesses. I think the third thing that we really try to push for the companies that we are involved with and that we mentor and invest in is really bringing the best talent from across Colombia and across the Americas to collaborate on great projects and build great companies together, and really creating sort of spaces, physical spaces, and also communities that allow people to come together to collaborate and solve issues that, you know, have a global scale and kind of a global product.
And that's what it has to be in this, that's so we say, globalized world. I mean, it has to reach beyond the national frontier. So that's the truth of it. These are coming down in this technological environment that we're talking about now. So very exciting that you should come back to do this, and it does sound like something that's very close to your heart. And of course, you're located in a wonderful part of Bogota that's, you know, we all love this Chapinero Rosales area with, as you say, great cocktail bars and you know, nightlife is good and the restaurants are good and it feels like a neighborhood here that you can wander around in. But I understand you've been traveling all around. I mean, you travel to the principal cities in Colombia as well for work. How has that been?
Oh, that has been so great, so, so great to come back to. As a kid with my family, I traveled all around Colombia. I would even joke irresponsibly, too much traveling around Colombia because it was between 1995 and 1999. But you know, I've really gotten to see Colombia in what it was, you know, 15 years ago or more, and what it is today. And it's so inspiring and lovely to see how much Colombia has changed. Medellin, as an example, is a city that just 15 years ago, I mean, even 20 years ago, people wouldn't go to, let alone tourists, international tourists would not think of going to Medellin as a fun city, really. There was so much danger associated with it. And today, Medellin, I think so many people are surprised to find, is such a progressive, open, international city. And I joke that it's the Brooklyn of Colombia. You know, it's so up and coming. There are so many entrepreneurs in the city. There are so many people that are investing in Medellin and in Antioquia that are hoping to make it a better place, including the local government that has done such a great job in using innovation tools as a means to changing what the city was 20 years ago. And so, you know, I think as I came back this year to work in Colombia, it was amazing to see a Colombia that I did not know. At a time that I really did not expect. The bars and the arts that I see across Colombia today, I really did not expect to see for many more years. And I don't mean the bars, that's so funny, but it's just, you know, the ability to sit down for coffee or have a cocktail and not worry about your safety. It's a privilege, really, and it's a privilege that a lot of cities in Colombia now have, and that I'm very happy and proud to see in my country.
That's fantastic to hear. Very positive there. Very positive indeed. Reinforcing the attitude that, you know, that a younger generation has towards Colombia in sort of in terms of altruism and socially minded growth, I think. And in Medellin, that is the most visible, perhaps, out of all of Colombian cities. Now, you did mention earlier that you said in that last blurb, let's say, you said your parents took you traveling irresponsibly between 1995 and around 1999. Why would you say that? I know why, but I need the listeners to hear why.
So it's kind of funny. I actually didn't realize how dangerous it might have been, perhaps just statistically, to have been on the road in Colombia in that range of years. So funny enough, I was reading an Economist article a few months ago, and they had done a special report on Colombia and the peace process. And a part of the special report basically had some graphs that explained how the safety situation had changed over the past 20 years. And one of the charts specifically pointed out kidnappings in Colombia. And between 1995 and about 2001, I mean, the numbers are just absurd. I was shocked to see what they were. And I called my parents after and asked them why we were on the roads in Colombia for all those years, really driving from coast to coast along all of the Andes, exploring all sorts of pueblos and beaches and towns deep in the Amazon jungle. I mean, everywhere. And I think it really just comes back to, you know, this funny premise that my parents have always had around Colombia and the safety of Colombia. And, you know, they've always felt that Colombia was their country and not the country of a few individuals that decided to make it feel unsafe. And so luckily nothing ever happened to us or anyone in our family, even our extended family. And perhaps for that, we are very, very lucky. But throughout the 90s, we traveled extensively around Colombia. And it's, I think it's actually been a wonderful experience now to see how much it's changed now that I get to see what it is today.
It's true. And did your parents ever respond to your question? It's like, how why do we do this? You know, why were we doing this during possibly some of the most violent times in Colombian history? Did they ever give you a reason?
You know, I think to them it was kind of a funny question to them, because it was never a question whether we would travel or not. They weren't going to change their lives and the quality of their lives and their ability to explore this absolutely stunning country for fear that they couldn't. You know, I think they almost took the responsibility of owning their country and doing so by traveling around it and exploring it and really getting to know it. And my father actually used to joke that he didn't want to leave Colombia until he had been to every single state in Colombia. And I think he accomplished that, actually. So to them, it wasn't even a question. It wasn't maybe even a question about safety. I think it was just a matter of owning the country and owning the opportunity to take advantage of this beautiful country.
I like this very much, because it's something that's a theme that comes up a lot, especially talking, well, in particular talking about Colombia. And I'm continually, let's say, trying to hammer home the need for Colombians to apropiarse, you know, of their own country. So that sense of belonging. Yes, Colombians are incredibly proud and incredibly noble people, but it's, if you take Bogota, you know, there's that, you know, nobody's from Bogota, you know, they'd rather say they're from somewhere else. But we're now seeing a new generation of Bogotanos saying, you know, proud to say they are from Bogota, proud to say that they're, you know, they belong to the city and the city belongs to them. And I think previously there's a long gap of several decades where you wouldn't say that. And so hearing about your parents, who may well have been the exception to the rule,
you know,
I can just imagine it's the very Colombian holiday. Everyone piling into the car with the family pet, perhaps the mother-in-law, you know, some stray cousin, and, you know, stopping at every junction along the way to eat the speciality food of that region. I can just imagine it, and stopping at the fruit stalls as well. And maybe, you know, I think it's a good image, you know, it's a good image, and it's given you a real appreciation, perhaps not back in the day, but now, a real appreciation of what is here and what is to be lived. I think it's really, really very special. So, but coming back to your work, it's taken you to Medellin, it's taken you to, I know that the other week when we talked about getting together to do this interview, you were in Santiago, was it, or Buenos Aires?
So we're going to be in Santiago and Buenos Aires.
Wow.
I think we've been, so far we've mostly focused on Costa Rica as a fantastic country that is so unique in Latin America just by virtue of the stability, the political stability, the economic stability that they've enjoyed when so many other countries in Central America and Latin America were falling apart. They have this, you know, unique opportunity to invest in their people and in the local talent, which is already so rich, in a way that we are very excited to collaborate on. And so thus far, we've really been researching ways that we could collaborate in Costa Rica with helping them catalyze what they've already built. They have such a strong base of technical talent, and that is so necessary and basic to an ecosystem that fosters technical and technological innovation and entrepreneurship. So thus far, you know, it's really been Colombia, Costa Rica, a little bit of Mexico, and with the new government change in Argentina, there's a lot of opportunity there as well. You know, I really see an upside to a lot of countries in Latin America right now, and it's exciting to be at the forefront of that.
Excellent. Do you see this as a, you know, a new era for Latin America then? I mean, or I don't like saying that, because that kind of sounds like a soundbite written in the Amarillista press, but there is something happening, isn't there?
You know what? I think what is specifically happening around the space that I'm involved in, which is the space that deals with technology as a tool for all types of opportunities, and in my case, for the opportunities to create great companies emerging from Latin America that grow and employ more people and bring wealth to the local cities that they are built in. Mm-hmm. I think there is a huge opportunity that not only Latin America is looking at, but countries all around the world are almost fighting for. And that is really the opportunity that technology is bringing with products, global companies that can really be built, you know, from anywhere. Examples like Waze that was built in Israel. I think WhatsApp was originally in an Eastern European country, if I'm not mistaken. You know, these are products that have changed the way that we interact in our day-to-day lives. And they're products that solve human problems, you know, the problems that we all face and are looking to solve. You know, Facebook could have been created anywhere in the world. We all want to connect with each other and keep in touch and communicate. And so I think really bringing that opportunity and that economic opportunity to Latin America is a very exciting opportunity, but we have to take it as a very serious economic opportunity and really give it the chance that it deserves to bring economic wealth to Latin America and to Latin American cities in a way that is not necessarily happening right now.
Wow, you know, you're deeply involved in this. You speak with a passion and an authority. This fills me with hope for these new technologies to help perhaps lift some people and some communities out of these desperate existences that maybe they are experiencing. And I want to bring this into sort of a final point, because Colombia has been, you know, it's been very pro this growth and very pro this new technology and industry. But there's a big but. I don't know if you can comment on this, but you know, we also feel, and there have been comments to the otherwise about the whole situation of this in talking about Uber, because of course it's one of those apps, and it's one of the things I love it, but it's encountered all sorts of problems here. We don't need to get into the nitty gritty of it,
mm-hmm.
but do you feel that the bureaucracy existing in Colombia is perhaps strangling a bit more of the growth?
That's a really good question, and I think Uber is actually such a perfect case for the barriers that innovative companies face all around the world. Uber has faced legal challenges,
everywhere.
Not only in Colombia, but really everywhere. It's been banned in some countries. And I think the one anecdote that I would share about Uber, from sort of less a professional and technical side, perhaps, but more from a personal side, is actually on the kinds of change that companies like Uber have on cultures in places like Bogota or like Colombia. One funny thing that happens every time that I get in an Uber in Bogota is, first of all, a rule here is that you get in the front seat. You get in the front seat because there is a contentious relationship between taxi drivers and Uber drivers. And so you really don't want to make it seem like you're getting in an Uber. You sit in the front seat. What that also creates is a sense that, yes, you are a passenger and you are sitting next to your driver, but because you're sitting right next to your driver, I think there's less of a barrier in kind of sharing that experience. And oftentimes I find myself in talking about so many different topics with my drivers, and they'll share with me their problems and the problems that they've maybe experienced with Uber or the problems that they're facing in their lives, social or financial or otherwise. And I think what that's created in me is actually this huge sense of empathy in the variety of lives that are lived in a place like Bogota. And I almost hope that, or wonder if this is happening to other Bogotanos or Colombians that are using this service, that they are speaking to people in social economic strata that they really would never find themselves in a conversation with. The cultural repercussions of that exchange can be so huge. And this is completely ignoring the economic repercussions of a company like Uber existing in Colombia. But I think culturally, that sort of company coming to a place like Colombia and instituting this very innovative idea that, you know, is servicing a lot of people in very positive ways, I might say, is it's an opportunity for sure. And I think there are a lot of barriers that Uber will face, not only in Colombia, but also in Latin America and all around the world, to figure out how they are going to fit into the bureaucratic systems that they're trying to integrate themselves into. But I really hope that the policies that the governments take to accept and involve these companies that are trying to expand into global markets and influence what innovative companies can do as they scale globally. I really hope that those policies are inviting, because if they are inviting of one company, they may be inviting of many other companies as well. And I think those are exactly the sort of open policies that we need in a global and globalizing world.
Fantastic. Great answer. Great answer. You can calm down now. Talking about breaking down barriers, I know of an English guy who's only just over here in Colombia for a few weeks on an investigation. And the first Uber taxi to pick him up was a lady driver, and they're now dating. So he must have sat in the front seat.
I'm sure he did.
There are some barriers that were broken down there. Best not dwell too much on that. But that's my little closing anecdote. Natalia, it has been a real pleasure to talk to you. You are someone who, again, like I mentioned earlier, you speak with authority and passion about what you're doing. You're genuinely making a difference here in Colombia. You've taken what you've learned overseas and brought it back to improve Colombian society in the way that you can. And so this is, you know, my hat goes off to you in this. It's been a real pleasure. And I hope I haven't presented you with too many difficult questions.
Thank you. No, not at all. Thank you so much, Richard.
You're most welcome. This is Colombia Calling. I'm Richard McColl. Episode 134. We've been talking to Natalia Quintero, who is a Bogotana by way of Los Angeles, New York, and now back to Bogota. I hope you've enjoyed this show. We'll be back next week with another interesting interview to share with you all. Thank you for listening.